I think people are starting to stream in now. Yep. I know we're 5 minutes. Good morning. You seen our appellants counsel here? They know that they know we're ready. Okay, perfect. That would be great. I assume they're ready. No, we're ready to proceed. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This is the final, fourth and final case scheduled for oral argument this morning. It is Sella Investments versus JH. Counsel, I know you're familiar with our proceedings. I'll just remind you that both sides will have 15 minutes to present their arguments. Counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I understand that the respondent and intervener have agreed to split time with the respondent having 10 minutes and the intervener taking 5 minutes. Is that accurate? All right. And it's important that you all state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument, because we are making an audio recording of this, and that is the only recording that is permitted. The podium can be raised and lowered with the button that's in the middle, right below the podium. And with that, counsel for appellant.
He was kind of tall, wasn't he? Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Christopher Kalla. I represent Sella Investments Limited, LLP, the appellant in this matter. This is an appeal from an order granting an expungement of a residential eviction case. The issue here today is very narrow. It is solely on the constitutionality of the statute 484.014. Respondent was a tenant in a multi-unit residential building in Minneapolis. In December of 2023, Sella filed an eviction against the tenant, alleging that he had made threats of violence, physical violence, against other tenants in the building. Summons was issued at the first appearance. The case was settled with a move-out date. All standard procedures in eviction cases. After the tenant moved out, tenant eventually requested an expungement of the case. The trial court granted that expungement on a rapid basis. There was no hearing held. The trial court, and that is at addendum one, cites only MnStat 484.014 subdivision 3 as its basis for expunging the case.
Let me ask you this. In the absence of a timely objection to the respondent's motion or a request for review, reconsideration by the district court, why shouldn't we conclude that you have forfeited your constitutional challenge?
Well, there was no hearing. The court received, I think, the expungement request at 3:45. Within an hour, the referee had recommended it to the district court for
right,
approval.
But 611 would have provided an avenue to challenge the district court order, would it not? Or
except
the housing court. No, the district court's agreement to the referee's recommendation.
So evictions being summary proceedings, there's a little bit of a disconnect between how eviction cases are handled both at the trial proceeding and post-judgment proceeding. Either party has an absolute right under 504B371 to appeal directly to the Court of Appeals. There is no requirement for a motion for reconsideration as you would typically see as a condition preceding for appeal in a typical civil action. And there's no requirement that you do a judge review under Rule 611. We've litigated that. The court's issued decisions on that as well.
Right, but generally constitutional issues are ones in which we prefer to have the district court decide it, have the issue presented to the district court, have the district court decide the issue, and then have an appeal so there's a record for us to review. We generally don't address constitutional issues at first blush here.
I guess we could have. I don't see that as a forfeiture of the right to appeal directly to this court.
There's a right to appeal, but there's no record for us to review on the constitutional issues that are being raised.
I mean, the court just decided they were bound to follow the statute. There's really, I mean, it's a bare record for sure, but I don't see that presenting a hindrance to this court to determine the constitutionality of the statute. I don't think that's a waiver at all.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that it's not. I have a couple of follow-up questions. One is, as you know, the district court cited to 484.014 subdivision 3. But the facts here, as you laid out, are that there's an eviction action, the parties entered into a settlement agreement, and then the tenant fulfilled the terms of the settlement, and the district court subsequently expunged it based on a motion brought by the tenant.
Yeah, I'm not going to dispute any of that factual predicate.
Right. So my question, based on those facts, isn't really the issue here under subdivision 3A7, which says upon a motion of a defendant, if the case is settled and the defendant fulfills the terms of the settlement, then the court shall expunge the eviction case?
Sure, and I think that's what we're talking about here, is that the court feeling mandated to expunge it because there was completion of a settlement agreement.
Right, but what I'm trying to do is just clarify that we're really not talking about subdivision A1 through 6. We're talking about subdivision 3A7.
I think we're talking about the entirety of subdivision 3, the mandatory expungement. This case does focus, you're correct, on subdivision 7, the confirmation, you know, the settlement aspect, yes.
Right, but we only decide cases based on the particular facts. So, for example, the issue isn't here whether the defendant prevailed on the merits under subdivision 3A2.
No, the issue, if I may, Your Honor, the issue is whether the state legislature has the authority in subdivision 3 at all to mandate that the judiciary expunge anything. In this particular case, we're talking about the settlement.
Well, then you're facing a particularly high burden there then, counsel, because you've made a facial challenge. You, if that's your argument, then you have to show that subdivision 3A 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7 and, are all facially unconstitutional in each and every single permutation.
Right. And I accept that challenge. I think we've met it. The separation of powers doctrine is clear. The legislature does not have the authority to improve. Yes.
Right. I understand your argument, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But I'm concerned that you might be biting off more than you can chew, and that your arguments don't address really 1 through 6, and that those issues really are not before us. It seems like the only issue that's really before us is whether or not the legislature can mandate and state that the court shall expunge an eviction case if the case is settled and the defendant fulfills the terms of the settlement.
Certainly, I would agree that this court has the authority to make a ruling on that aspect of the constitutionality challenge. I do, however, think that this court also could go further and go to all 7 of those based off of the briefing that we have here. Keep in mind, we're not saying that the courts don't have the authority to expunge. To the contrary, the appellant here feels that the court has inherent authority to expunge eviction records as a discretionary method based off of the you know, I think the concurring opinion in the At-Home Apartments lays out some factors that are helpful, sure. But to say for the legislature to compel the court to do anything with its records under any circumstances, I think that's where the overreach happens. Now, if this court wants to say, you know what, we're fine with 1 through 7. We are going to, as a matter of common law, acquiesce to the legislature's directions in this statute. That's fine. But that hasn't happened yet. And this court, in its trial order expunging the case, didn't say, we're going to acquiesce. It just said, we're compelled to. The court in its trial order didn't analyze any of the factors from at-home apartments and say, in the exercise of discretion, we think expungement is appropriate. And this appeal is not looking to affect the court's ability to do that. We're saying that is the court's obligation to do that, to exercise its inherent authority and not take the simple directive from the legislature and just do it.
Can I ask you this? In the context of criminal records, appellate courts have long recognized and applied both statutory expungement and expungement of records based on the court's inherent authority to do so. What is it about this statute or eviction records that raises particular separation of powers concern when 609A.03 does not?
So I think there's less of a constitutional issue with, I mean, somebody gets charged with a case and is acquitted. There's a constitutional due process that perhaps that shouldn't be held against them.
Let me be more precise. Let's talk about separation of powers problem. Okay. Because, again, there's been statutory expungement of criminal records and expungement by virtue of the district court's inherent authority to do that. And those have coexisted without problem. What is it about this legislative, the statutory expungement here that crosses the line and deprives the courts of their power or implicates the court's exercise of it?
Well, perhaps in your own question, you've indicated that those other statutes have coexisted without a problem. Maybe nobody's objected, or maybe the courts were involved in co-drafting that legislation in the first place. I don't think that's what happened here.
But weren't I know in 2023, the statute was amended to add many more bases for the mandatory expungement, but am I correct that even before 2023, mandatory expungement was in the statute? That in and of itself is not new, is it?
I don't think that is new. I think this is the first time this is being challenged. And to address your question, I don't know of any cases where those other criminal statutes expungement was challenged. I mean, if all the parties are fine with certain cases getting expunged and it never comes to this court or any court for a challenge of the constitutionality, that question is never going to get raised. It's never going to get addressed.
Counsel, would you agree that this is an issue of first impression here in terms of a challenge to the separation of powers challenge regarding expungement of records?
Yes. You know, when I was researching this, I was doing the Westlaw key site search, and there's a lot of, you know, they talk about in the separation of powers doctrine, you know, the courts infringing upon the legislature, courts infringing upon the executive, executive infringing upon both. But the number of cases where the legislature is infringing upon the judiciary, it's almost non-existent nationwide. So, yes, I would acknowledge that this is a case of first impression.
And that was going to be my next question. Do you know of any other courts throughout the country that have addressed this issue?
I would have cited them. Yep. I looked and I was surprised that not once, even at the district court level, now with the internet, you know, filtering everything out there, I couldn't find anything. And, you know, the amicus addresses all these other cases where expungement wasn't found unconstitutional. Not one of those cases was constitutionality an issue in
okay.
that case.
I want to go to the substance of the argument and separation of powers, because the legislature can provide relief, but it can't infringe upon, like, for instance, procedural matters. And I think you cited to the Minnesota Supreme Court's order saying to the legislature on a separate statute, you know, we govern our own procedures. And I understand your argument here to be that because Subdivision 3 talks about mandatory expungement, that it's infringing upon a district court's ability to decide cases. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, I think the inherent authority of the court is not just to do something, it's also to not do something. And I think Justice Gilday, in that August 2023, I believe, order on the non-public statute, was pretty clear that the court has inherent authority over its own records. And to address the substantive remedy, I mean, I think it's a false choice to say that the inherent authority of the courts is only as to procedural matters. I think clearly procedural matters, Jen, has a greater deference of inherent authority to the courts. But the idea that the legislature is creating a substantive remedy here in this statute for tenants, I think is not accurate. 504B173, the recent enactment, and this is at page 5 of my, I believe, my reply brief, talks about cases that didn't result in a writ on a tenant. Those eviction cases can't be used for prospective tenancies for consideration. I think that's the type of substantive right the legislature is more authorized to enact in this arena.
But this statute, you know, it allows a tenant to file a motion. It gives the district court the ability to make a couple of findings that the case had been settled and that the defendant had fulfilled the terms of the settlement. So why aren't those guardrails or provisions in the statute enough to address any separation of powers concerns? It still is within the inherent power of the district court to make those decisions. And once decisions are made, the findings are made, then the statutory requirement of mandatory expungement is triggered.
I think it's an odd setting that the state legislature informs the court as to what the court's inherent authority is. I mean, all those issues you've just addressed, the court already has the inherent authority.
Well, that's under subdivision 2, though. The legislature explicitly acknowledges the district court's inherent authority, but why, under subdivision 3, as Judge Bond pointed out, there are still certain findings that district court has to make, and it's only if the district court makes those findings, then they can seek expungement.
I think subdivision 2 is entirely superfluous, that the legislature, again, tells the court what its inherent authority is. With respect, you know that. We all know what the court's inherent authority is. With regards to subdivision 3, all of those guidelines and conditions precedent and those metrics there, that's something, again, the court already has within its authority to look at and decide under its inherent authority and the factors in the at-home apartment's concurring opinion. Is expungement appropriate in that circumstance? Are the public benefits outweighed by the private benefits of an expungement? All of that is already out there. We don't need the legislature telling the court what to do and how to weigh these cases. I mean,
the legislature does that all the time in terms of issuing statutes that say, okay, and evictions are a creature of statutory construction. So the legislature created the eviction statute in the first place. So it has the ability to say, here are the remedies with respect to an eviction, and here are the remedies with respect to expungement of an eviction. But the legislature isn't saying that expungement is just mandatory if a person asks for it. There are certain steps under subdivision 3A7 that a tenant has to meet. And the district court has to find that there's a settlement agreement, which the district court did here. The district court has to find that the defendant fulfilled the terms of the settlement agreement, which is not in dispute here as well. And then the defendant has to make a motion, and then the other party has an opportunity to oppose that motion as well. And the district court would make an ultimate determination as to whether or not those conditions are met. And if and only if they are met, then is expungement mandatory. Why isn't that sufficient to avoid a separation of powers issue?
Because the court already has the inherent authority to do all of that.
But that's a separate issue. We're talking, this is a statutory.
I think to say just because the legislature can really only act through statutes. And just because they act through a statute, I don't think that insulates them from a separation of powers problem when they are intruding upon something that, as Justice Gilday said, is within the inherent authority. And none of the countering briefs here counter that inherent authority presumption. The management of judicial records is inherent authority, and that is a given in this case. It's undisputed.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Then we will hear first from counsel for respondent or from the intervener? Intervener, all right. So that is 5 minutes. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Madeline DeMel, and I'm an assistant attorney general appearing today on behalf of intervener Keith Ellison, attorney general for the state of Minnesota. The attorney general has intervened in this matter for the limited purpose of defending the expungement statute's constitutionality and respectfully request that this court reject landlord's challenge to the same.
Counsel, what are the limits on the legislature's power to require the judiciary to expunge its records? I mean, could the legislature pass a statute that says you must expunge all criminal records once the defendant has sentence has expired?
Your Honor, a couple of answers to that question, and I think it really gets at some of the themes in this matter. First, I think it's important to grapple with this idea of what is constitutional power and that it's not zero sum across the branches. Just because the court has X amount of power over here doesn't mean that the other branches power is reduced by a proportionate amount. Just because the legislature has Y power doesn't mean the court's power is reduced by a corresponding amount. Certainly, there are limits on what the legislature can do, and I think the limits when it comes to expungement are going to turn on procedural versus substantive distinctions. That's a theme we see in a lot of separation of powers cases, and I would point, Your Honors, I don't recall the exact case, but one of the cases cited, I want to say it was Sanchez, pertained to statute of limitations provisions. And the court made an analysis that said in some instances, statute of limitations really do have an outcome determinative or a substantive effect. In other cases, they really are more of a procedural matter. And so we look in a particular case to see what the impact of the legislative action is to sort of determine, has it gone too far into a procedural realm, in which case we might be brushing up against those limits of legislative power due to infringement on judicial power. But if it's substantive, that's sort of in the heartland of what the legislature can and should be doing with its constitutional power. And on that note of what the legislature's power is, I think the analogy to Chapter 609A is really helpful here. Just like the legislature has the power to define what constitutes criminal conduct as a matter of substance, the legislature in Chapter 504B has really globally regulated, so to speak, the field of landlord-tenant law in the state of Minnesota. And because of that, 484.014 is a really harmonious component of the legislature's action.
I will acknowledge it's analogous to 609A, but are you aware of any challenges to the constitutionality of 609A?
I'm not aware of any challenges to the constitutionality of that, Your Honor. And I think that's because the courts sort of have recognized perhaps as an unspoken matter, but
well, the courts can't do anything unless a challenge is brought.
That's true, Your Honor, although we do have dicta to provide guidance when we are encountering questions of first impression. And I do think dicta in prior cases pertaining to Section 609 is helpful here.
The distinction I see between 609A.03 and the 484.041 is I'm looking in Subdivision 5, the nature of the expungement remedy. And in Part B, it talks about the court shall grant the petition to seal the record unless the agency or jurisdiction whose records would be affected establishes by clear and convincing evidence that the interests of public safety outweigh the disadvantages to the petitioner of not sealing. That suggests to me that the court has a role, that the court gets to exercise its discretion in deciding whether its own records must be, you know, should be expunged or not. I don't see anything in 484.014 Subdivision 3 that really gives courts any discretion that if these facts exist, we have no discretion but to expunge our own records.
Your Honor, I acknowledge that's a difference, but I think to Judge Bond's earlier point about the court still having a role in these determinations, the court is still making findings. Has the eviction matter proceeded properly to date? Has there been a settlement? Has the settlement, in fact, been complied with? The court isn't simply sitting by while an automatic expungement process unfolds without any involvement or sort of gatekeeping from anyone. And so in this case, I think it's a policy judgment that the legislature made in certain circumstances. The role of the court might be more limited, and that's appropriate for the legislature to make. I see my time has expired, Your Honors. One non-argument note, if I may, just about the authorship of the brief. Our office did want to recognize a student attorney who participated in the drafting of our brief, 2024-2025 Sakes Public Interest Fellow, Anthony Ellis, contributed significantly, and we just wanted to recognize his work for the court's benefit.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that work. Counsel for respondent. You may proceed.
Thank you. Your Honors, Counsel, may it please the Court. My name is Elizabeth Frazier. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, and I'm here today with my colleague Walter Burke, representing the respondent, J.H. The material facts are not at issue in this case. If the statute is constitutional, the respondent qualified for a mandatory expungement of the underlying eviction action based on his compliance with the terms of a settlement agreement, and the district court did not err in granting that requested relief. Here, the appellant has not met their burden of establishing beyond a reasonable doubt that the statute is unconstitutional in all aspects or applications. Rather, the statute at issue here is a permissible exercise of the legislature's constitutional authority to regulate eviction records. Respondent in this case is asking for the court to affirm the district court's order granting an expungement of the underlying eviction action by removing evidence of those records from the court's publicly accessible databases. The statute at issue here is an act of the legislature in exercising their constitutional powers to address housing issues.
So is it your position that this is a remedy, that the treatment of the records after the fact and under the circumstances enumerated in subdivision 3 really constitute how the legislature has defined this law and a remedy that it's created as part of the overall housing code?
It is, Your Honor. Evictions themselves are a creature of statute created by the legislature, and as such, the legislature has acted to kind of control those records, or not control those records, and to just control the records, but to create a remedy for the tenants and defendants that have been in those eviction actions. And in doing so, it wasn't an enactment in a procedural sense to control the court records for the purpose of controlling court records. Rather, it was that substantive remedy providing for relief for these tenants and eviction actions that in a certain defined set of circumstances, the legislature has held has found that policy is, those policy considerations are in those enumerated circumstances met when those facts can be established for the court.
Is there an analogous situation in which the legislature has similarly acted to control the judicial branch's, treatment of its own records in a way that's passed separation of powers and other constitutional muster?
Sure. I know in the criminal context, as was discussed earlier, the case I wanted to point to was State v. SLH. And in that case, the court does find that there's two distinct separate fonts for expungement or sources of authority for expungement that can coexist constitutionally, and that is the inherent authority that is constitutionally sourced in the courts to control their own records, and the legislative authority to pass those policy initiatives.
I have a question in terms of, a couple questions. One is, would you agree that really the only provision that's at issue is subdivision A1, or subdivision 3A7?
Your Honor, in this situation, I believe that the appellant has raised a facial challenge to the entire statute. I think the court could rule more narrowly on the issue that's presented to them in this case, being the compliance with the terms of a settlement agreement. But it is our position that the appellant has raised a broader facial challenge to the statute.
Even if one is brought, we have to address issues that are before us. And I don't know if the facts here actually fit into any of the other ones, do they?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. And I would agree that in this case, it's a more narrow question, despite kind of being challenged more broadly. And so it would be appropriate for the court to kind of focus on the facts at issue in this case and the settlement agreement provision.
I have a question also about the mandatory nature of it. Even if the district court has authority to decide whether or not the case is settled or the defendant fulfills the terms of the settlement, hasn't the legislature taken away the district court's ultimate authority to determine whether or not expungement is appropriate in that particular type of situation?
I would, one, challenge that expungement is essentially the full destruction of judicial records. It's really removal of those records from public access, so it refers more to the public access to those records. But rather than kind of removing all of the court's inherent authority or discretion in that case, I think it's really more of a fact that the legislature has found these policy considerations to be important enough to kind of enumerate for the court. But also, as referred to by the interveners, it's not some sort of automated process without a court order. And in fact, that brings me to a position of the appellant where it was mentioned that public access is presumed and that's not disputed. In this case, I would say it is disputed because there's an exception to that presumption of public access. And one of those exceptions is when public access is removed pursuant to a court order. In this case and in the statute, the expungement comes pursuant to a court order and court findings. And so I think is an exception to that rebuttable presumption of the right to access.
But aren't you talking about inherent authority by a court to expunge?
I think in this case, I would be thinking about both, but really, can you repeat your question?
I mean, does that really answer the question? I mean, and I know what you're saying, that, you know, the presumption of public access is defeated if there's an order to the contrary. But the issue here is whether this order was something that was mandated by the legislature or something over which the district court here did have a matter of discretion and could make a decision about.
Again, the district court would have the ability to review the affidavit and the motion and determine if the facts are supported to meet the mandatory provisions. Additionally, the district...
But if they are, and again, I think in many of these circumstances, it's going to be facts that are undisputed, right? Or there would... but at that point, if there is a settlement and the defendant vacated in time, as the circumstances here, this court had no option but to grant expungement. In fact, its order says the case must be expunged.
Correct. In the situation after the settlement was entered into and adopted by the court, it made it subject to the provisions of that law. And I would note that the settlement was entered into right before that law took effect. It was known by the parties that law would be taking effect. And nothing was noted to the contrary, that they would not agree to that. And the court approved that settlement with the understanding knowing that new law would be taking effect. So I think the court has a role to play in the beginning of a case and accepting that settlement, as well as a verification of the facts in the affidavit and the motion. And there are avenues for the appellant to, or for a plaintiff to counter those facts in the motion, whether it be a motion for judge review or a motion for reconsideration. And that's something that happens kind of frequently in housing court where, for example, a writ of recovery is entered without a hearing and the facts are disputed. Then there's another motion that can be filed to kind of dispute that at the district court level before something rises to the level of an appeal.
So in that situation, let's say the defendant files a motion to expunge and the plaintiff opposes that motion and says, no, I don't want expungement. Does the district court have any authority to deny the expungement motion if there was a settlement agreement and the defendant fulfilled the terms of the settlement agreement?
Not if the court finds that those facts are substantiated.
In that case, hasn't the legislature taken away the district court's discretion to ultimately decide a case?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I would say that entering into the settlement agreement is what allows for that expungement to come after it's complied with. And so really, if we're looking at who is what is removing the court's power to not agree with a mandatory expungement if the settlement is complied with, is the parties when entering into that settlement agreement.
Can you talk about the second issue briefly about the and whether or not that issue is even before us as well? And I think you touched on the standing issue in your brief.
Just briefly, and just briefly here before we move on, I just wanted to talk about the Supreme Court's order invalidating the non-public filings. I think there's separate policy concerns and considerations when looking at the non-public filings when a case is proceeding before the conclusion of a case. And Chief Justice Gilday was largely looking, I believe, at the kind of procedural logistical challenges of those records being removed from public access before the conclusion of a case. And now to speak about the First Amendment, is the respondent's position that the First Amendment challenge was waived by the appellant and is not properly in front of the court for consideration? A challenge regarding the constitutionality of the statute was not raised at the district court when entering into the settlement or in any pleadings prior to the brief, the principal brief of appellant. Respondent further supports it was the position of intervener that there's no standing for the First Amendment issue in this case, and that if not waived, they do lack the standing to raise a First Amendment issue, and that this court need not rule on the issue of the First Amendment, but if they do, then there is no First Amendment constitutional considerations that are implicated here by the expungement of eviction records. In conclusion, Your Honors, the appellant has failed to meet burden required for this court to find that the statute is unconstitutional on its face or as applied to the facts in this case. As such, the appellant's argument and challenge must fail. Accordingly, respondent is asking this court to affirm the district court's order granting an expungement of the underlying eviction action by removal of that evidence of those records from the court's publicly accessible databases. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kahlo, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. So I'll first start with who hasn't met the burden here. This statute offends the First Amendment and the separation of powers. The strict scrutiny standard, and this is at page 7, I think, of my reply brief, talks about content-based restrictions on free speech survive First Amendment strict scrutiny analysis only if they are necessary to serve a compelling state interest and are narrowly drawn to achieve that end. The statute is narrowly tailored if it advances a compelling state interest in the least restrictive means among available alternatives. We have available alternatives, 504B178. That explains to everybody, if you don't have a writ from an eviction, it can't be used against you. And that pretty much addresses all of the issues in the amicus brief from Homeline as to the problems that people encounter when they have an eviction on the record. We're not minimizing that, but we're saying there are alternative remedies. 504B178 does that. The other existing remedy the tenants have is the discretionary expungement. We're not challenging the authority of the court to issue expungements. We're not saying the court shouldn't issue expungements, but there are some cases, and we talk about those at pages 6 to 8 on my response brief. I'm sorry, the other cases are at pages 8 to 10 on my response brief. We have a homicide, arson, assault, fraud, monumental, unpaid rents. All of those cases I've identified are required to be expunged. In the stabbing case, the PPL case, Mr. Lamar Green, I actually asked the court in advance of this statute becoming effective after it was enacted to make a note on the record that my client opposes expungement. The referee said she would make no such finding that we oppose the expungement, even at the point of the default proceeding. So the idea that we need to anticipate statutes that have not yet become effective, I don't think that waives anything from the landlord's right to ask for this case to be found, the statute to be found unconstitutional.
Well, the arguments you're making there, they seem to go to subdivision 3A5 that you cited in your reply brief.
Right.
But you didn't make those arguments on that in your initial brief. And I'm curious, I know you're making a facial challenge to the entire subdivision 3. But I didn't see any arguments on any of the other ones. For example, if the complaint is dismissed for any reason, let's assume a plaintiff dismisses the complaint, why shouldn't the tenant be able to get an expungement of the complaint having been filed against him in the first place?
I think they probably should. I think the court has inherent authority at the first appearance to do exactly that.
But your facial challenge to the constitutionality, you have to show that it would be unconstitutional in any situation. And that one, it seems like you're actually conceding that they should be able to be entitled to that remedy.
If the legislature wanted to say the court has the discretion to authorize expungements in these following cases, that'd be different. But they're not. They're saying you must, under all circumstances, you must expunge. If I had a case where I filed the eviction and the tenant moves out, people consider eviction courts possession only, I'm required to dismiss that case. Sometimes the courts will dismiss the case if they find out the tenant's moved out, even if they've committed a homicide or an arson or owe $20,000 in debt. That the court is required to expunge that case in those circumstances, I don't think that's appropriate. And my facial challenge is on the word mandatory, not that the courts don't have the authority or that the legislature doesn't have the ability to recognize the court's authority, but that they're requiring it.
So this might be a little bit out of the scope, but we have talked about 609A as well, and they use the word automatic there, not mandatory, but I think they're using it in a parallel fashion. Is your position that those would be similarly subject, constitutionally infirm as well then?
I don't know much of a difference between automatic versus mandatory. I think, Judge Borkman, you had the discussion about, you know, the court still has to hold a hearing and make certain findings. I'm not as familiar with 609 as I am with 484, but I think, yeah, it's potentially open to a challenge if somebody were to challenge it. I don't think this court's ruling today necessarily says 609 and the expungement statute there is also unconstitutional, because that's not before. I'm not asking the court to do that. And I understand the analogy perhaps makes my request a bit weaker. But nonetheless, the fact that the legislature is mandating the court without the authority to say no, we don't think this case should be expunged. I think that's the problem that this statute has. I mean, who's to stand up for the judiciary? You know, a private litigant has to come to court, has to come to the Court of Appeals. I think that error in the trial court is simply acceding automatically without any discussion to the statute. They know. The trial court knows that there are concerns from the landlord's bar as to the constitutionality. They knew going in before this court order was signed that there were constitutional issues. They simply chose to concede to the statute.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel for your arguments today. They were helpful. We appreciate them. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. That being the last matter on our calendar for argument, we are in recess.
All rise.